cheer the worshipers? Where's all of my praises? I want everybody around the world to put your hands together because all the praise belongs to God. Here we go.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. At a special health retreat is a fundraiser for our sister station, WBAI, in New York. Wonderful group of people, some remarkable improvements already. You'll be hearing from them on Friday's show. Today, curcumin could help combat stomach cancer, Federal University in Brazil, and about 14 other articles from the world literature showing how simple lifestyle choices can allow us to live a longer and healthier life. We have a guest in the second part of our program. We're going to talk about the beginning of the autism epidemic, something no one ever discusses. It's one of modern medicine's greatest tragedies. And coming to us from North Carolina will be a gentleman who is keen on the subject, and his name is Force Maretti. And he is an independent historical expert, a scholar, and he is going to share his research on this. He's done a lot of work, by the way. He's the creator of the popular video series, My Incredible Opinion, on Vax Baby. So that's coming. Also, I have your questions that I'll be taking, and if time permits, two commentaries that I'll ask your input on. One is about how to escape the age of mass delusion. That was the topic of my lecture last night, or how do we go from delusion to changing our perception of what is real and is delusional so we can regain our health. This is from Stella Morbido, and I'll talk about that. And also, if time permits, I'm not sure it will, I thought our ever deadlier police state that we're all concerned with, Danny Sheehan, John Whitehead, these are constitutional lawyers, and Chris Hedges. And so we'll share some insight from Chris. We also have some audio clips today that we'll be going to, and especially on our educational system, how toxic it has become and why, and what we can do to get it back. So we have a packed hour. So we're going to begin today with, as we always do, the latest on health and healing. Now, research reported in the peer-reviewed journal Epigenomics reveals a potential role for curcumin and other natural compounds in the prevention or treatment of stomach cancer. And that's important because stomach cancer is deadly. It's a major cancer and it kills a lot of people. And what they found is that histones are proteins that exist in the cell's nuclei, which organize DNA into structural units called nucleosomes. And these nucleosomes are made of DNA coiled around the histones. I don't want to be too technical, but that is which compact the DNA, make it more condensed. And research suggests that histone modifications, such as caused by gene expression, that influence the development of some cancers. So if these are gone awry, you can end up with a cancer, stomach cancer being one of the leading causes. So they found that curcumin, that's the active ingredient in turmeric, as well as resveratrol, that you find in grapes, and quercetin, you find that in onions and apples, and garcinol from Garcinia indica, these all make a major impact. So the lay language understanding is if you want to help prevent or treat stomach cancer, curcumin is one of the most powerful things you can use, along with acai and hogberry, H-O-B-E-R-R-Y, quercetin, and resveratrol. Just, we always like to tell you what's going on. University of Luxembourg, the right combination of diet and good bacteria limits cancer's progression. So what this means is this. As you know from listening to this program, the diet of a person can have significant effects on the gut microbiome, meaning the population of the good microorganisms, the good bacteria, which live in the human gut. It is well recognized that dietary habits, through complex metabolic interactions, contribute to cancer prevention. More specifically, diets rich in fibers reduce the risk of developing specific cancers like colorectal cancer. Now, though such diets are an effective means of cancer prevention, their possible roles in cancer progression and treatment is not as well accepted. But the science is certainly gaining momentum to show that. So yes, we know that about 30 to 50 grams of fiber a day can help prevent cancer. But what will it also do if you already have cancer? Here's where it gets interesting. When you're eating a wide variety of different foods, you're getting a wide variety of different fibers. The fiber in a blueberry and a raspberry and a cherry and a strawberry are different than the fiber in, let's say, millet, which is a grain, or rice, quinoa, which is different than the fiber in a nut, or a seed, a sunflower seed, pumpkin seed, almond, pecan. All of these are important. They all are beneficial. And they go into the intestine, and then with a good diet and the good fiber, the gut begins to transform good bacteria by the hundreds of billions of good bacteria. We call these probiotics or prebiotics, and that means that we need them. They're absolutely essential. So when you're on the average American diet of alcohol and fast foods and refined carbohydrates and meats and fried foods, you're creating harmful bacteria, and that destroys your immune system and adversely affects your metabolism. So just eat healthy and have a good chance of preventing cancer or helping to reverse the cancer based upon the fiber. Also from Hasselt University, which is in Belgium, environmental pollutants could impact your cellular signs of aging. What do I mean? I mean that researchers have linked some environmental pollutants with diseases, a decreased lifespan and signs of premature aging, like wrinkles and age spots, but can accelerate aging by be detected at the cellular level in healthy people exposed to pollutants. Now research published in the Environmental Science and Technology Journal report that although pollutant exposure can affect two hallmarks of aging in people, the mitochondrial DNA content and telomere length, the results are not so clear-cut. But what we do know is this. If you work in a polluted area, if you live in a polluted area, if you live where there's water that's polluted, which is all over America, in fact, 5,000 communities and cities have water equally or worse than Flint, Michigan. And so every time they take a drink, every time they shower, they're causing DNA damage. If you live in a city that's got particulate matter, now, of course, we look at a city like Shanghai or Beijing or Calcutta, and you think, wow, those are really polluted. Yes, they are. But we have cities like New York City, it's also polluted. San Francisco's polluted. Los Angeles is polluted. And particulate matter in the air is very harmful. So, what this is saying is that if you want to stay healthy, you don't want shorter telomeres. That's a hallmark of aging. When you're sedentary, shorter telomeres. When you exercise daily, longer telomeres, hence longer life. When you're eating meat and processed carbohydrates, shorter telomeres. When you're eating a healthy plant-based diet, longer telomeres, longer life. When you're drinking healthy juices and healthy clean water, longer telomeres. When you're eating and drinking from a standard diet high in fructose, shorter telomeres. When you're stressed, shorter telomeres. When you're relaxed and meditative, longer telomeres. You see, so it's not that difficult to realize how many different efforts are we making to stop what is causing us to prematurely age, and with that, diseases of premature aging. And it all is about the DNA and how we adversely affect them. Now, from the State University of Maringá in Brazil, lemongrass essential oil protects the liver from chemical-induced injury. This was published in the American Journal of Chinese Medicine, and it talked about lemongrass. And by the way, lemongrass is a great detoxifier. I love to make lemongrass tea. You know, you boil up some water, put your lemongrass in it, then turn it off, let it steep, and the oils are released from the fibrous material of the lemongrass. And after about 20 minutes, then you've made your own lemongrass infusion. Now, you can add some stevia to it. A vanilla stevia is very tasty. There's even a lemon, natural lemon stevia. Doesn't have calories. And even if you are going to have some other sweetener, maple syrup, first high-grade dark maple syrup is your best. And then Manuka honey is good, and it's medicinal. So then now you have a grate, and then put some ice, grate tea, and put some ice in there, and you got a great lemongrass tea. It's very refreshing, but also it's protecting your liver. That's right. The oils from lemongrass protect your liver, and that's important. And it doesn't take a lot to do it. So just something, and it can help detoxify from a lot of the chemicals that we're exposed to. Also, breastfeeding boosts metabolites important for brain growth. This is from the Children's National Hospital. So preemies, who primarily consume breast milk, have significantly higher levels of metabolites important for brain growth and development. And breast milk is always better than formula because it provides critical nutrients and diverse array of antioxidants and that are protective. And now we know that if you're breastfeeding, you're going to have a better developed brain. So that's important. That's something good. And you've heard me mention acrylamide, A-C-R-Y-L-A-M-I-D-E. According to a Danish Cancer Society's research, acrylamide increases women's breast cancer risk. All right, that's important. So where do we get acrylamides? How can we say, okay, got the message, want to prevent it? Muffins, pizzas, bagels, potato chips, french fries, sandwiches, especially toast. Any carbohydrate that has been cooked to where it's brown, that creates acrylamides. So that, the grilling, the frying, that increases the risk of breast cancer. They looked at 24,697 postmenopausal women as part of this study over a period of years and found, wow, those who have the most of these browned carbohydrates have much higher risk of breast cancer. So let's not eat those foods that way. Also, from Florida Atlantic University, pre-existing inflammation can help promote the spread of cancer. New research reporting in the Journal of Leukocyte Biology suggests that allergic reactions, or at least the pre-existing inflammation from these reactions, can set the stage for cancer to spread from one area to another. You've heard me mention many times that inflammation is the top leading biological cause of almost all disease, cancer, diabetes, heart disease, dementia, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, ALS, arthritis. So one of the things we can do is we can pay attention and turn off inflammation. Just having a glass of juice in the morning, a green juice where you put even a little amount, an ounce of lemon juice, using the skin too, ginger, about a 1 to 2 inch piece of ginger juice, apple cider vinegar, a teaspoon, doesn't have to be more than that, and then dilute that with 16 ounces of green apple, celery, and cucumber. That can turn off inflammation all over the body, and that can help you. And finally, vitamin D was shown to make a difference with diabetic foot ulcers. When you consider how many people die of, let's say, gangrene, or have amputations of toes and feet and legs, it's a big deal. Something that inexpensive and that simple to get, vitamin D, but we're not getting enough of it. And that's unfortunate. That's the latest, well, one last one, from Green Med Info, Sarah G. Sweating removes deadly chemicals from the body. That's right. a good bunch of studies now show that the act of sweating when you're exercising or in a sauna, that goes a long way to removing dangerous industrial chemicals from your body. So let's sweat. We'll be back in a moment with your calls. Please stay with us.
Today, I was happy as a lark.
Hey Gary, my name is Valerie Lashak. We met years ago, maybe in the 60s in New York City. I now live on Maui. I listened to your program, podcasting it, and I heard a man say that it was possible to delineate the DNA of the measles that is now the outbreak of our country. And I was wondering whether a DNA has been done, because it's really important to know whether ordinary measles is being spread or the DNA measles from the vaccines are being spread. I'm very curious. I'm anti-vaccination, except it's necessary, and I don't want to have anybody forced to have a vaccine that is just propaganda.
Currently, virtually everything that you're reading in the mainstream media and from Mayor de Blasio and from members of Congress, all of that is a well-orchestrated propaganda campaign, because measles is not a disease. It's an infection. It's an airborne infection. We get it when people breathe, and particulate matter from the virus is shed and goes into the air. Those closest are going to be exposed to it. And that's why people in a house frequently come down with it, unless they have previously had natural measles. We did the study. We reviewed all of the scientific literature over the past 200 years on measles. And in point of fact, measles was about 99% gone before the vaccine was even invented and brought onto the market. So for them to take credit for supposedly eradicating measles with the vaccine is simply not true on any level. It is an out-and-out fabrication. You could find this for yourself. Separately, when you did get the measles, you got an infection. The infection would cause a spike in fever. You would be in bed. You would get some baths to cool down the inflammation. And if your family members knew anything about building your immune system, you would have had vitamin C and other nutrients that would have helped limit the amount of time that you were infected. In point of fact, I had measles, I had chickenpox, I had mumps, and now I'm immune for life, as millions of my generation are. But then they realized how easy it is to trick people by fear. And so then the MMR vaccine, Merck's vaccine, was brought into market, and it was not widely used until the indemnification, meaning they were made harmless from any litigation. So if every vaccine they created killed every person that took it, they could not be sued. And that was purely political. And the person that caused that, I think it was Dick Amory, went to work for the pharmaceutical industry. And by the way, that's the way it works in Washington. But just look at the peer-reviewed literature. If you want to talk back reasonably and sensibly to a pro-vaccine zealot, the most famous peer-reviewed shedding case is the one in New York City theater district of a recently MMR-vaccinated woman getting her coworkers sick from measles, yet she was fully vaccinated. I believe it was back in 2014, a Dr. Gregory Polin, editor-in-chief of the journal Vaccine, which is the number one vaccine scientific publication in America, and founder of the Mayo Clinic's Vaccine Research Group, published an alarming statement, and I want you to remember what I'm about to tell you, because this ends much of the argument. He says that the vaccines that we have today, the measles vaccine, has a poor efficacy record, meaning it doesn't work in a lot of the cases. In fact, during the first half of 2014, there were 16 large measles outbreaks in the U.S., and Dr. Poland does not believe this is due to unvaccinated individuals, but because the vaccine's failure to conform and confer immunity. Now, during the first 6 months of 2011, because I just finished writing an article on this that'll be posted next week, there were 118 cases of measles reported to the CDC from 23 states and New York City. There were no deaths. Now, among the 118 cases, 105 were both import-associated. What's that mean? And unvaccinated. It means these were people coming with wild virus infection from other countries. And that's how an awful lot of the measles was spread. Now, the 87 U.S. residents who came down with measles, 74 were unvaccinated, and 39 under the age of 20. And in one measles clinical trial, 13 of the group, which is 17.5%, had received the mRNA vaccine. They got the measles anyhow. And one thing is certain. All of the unvaccinated people who came down with measles now have a lifelong immunity against measles. For those who became infected despite having been vaccinated, the judgment is still out. Do you remember the Disneyland measles outbreak? A huge moneymaker for Merck. In a single quarter after the outbreak, measles vaccine sales increased 24%. I believe it was Bloomberg Business News that reported that. Then there was a study in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Only 14% of those infected with measles at Disneyland were not vaccinated. That's very, very low. The vast majority were completely vaccinated. But officials want to blame unvaccinated persons for the outbreak. If 86 of those contracting measles were vaccinated, then herd immunity for measles is a fantasy. And we all know in real science that it is. They want to blame your unvaccinated child who is healthy for giving them an infection after they've been immunized for it. Well, why don't you pull back from that and ask yourself, within how efficacious is a vaccine if the person getting the vaccine becomes infected? In 2013, there was a published report on vaccine strain measles occurring weeks after the mRNA vaccine in Canada. I'll paraphrase the author. He described the case of a measles, mumps, rubella, the mRNA vaccine, associated measles illness that was positive for both the PCR and the IMG 5 weeks after administration of the mRNA vaccine, which means the people who were fully vaccinated were transmitting the genetic variants into other people. And that answers your question. Now, the Journal of Biomedical Science, I'm not sure, I think it was 2002, there was a study analyzing the effects of the MMR on the nervous system and found that the measles, mumps, rubella vaccinated children with autism had a type of antibody that was triggering an abnormal autoimmune response that damages the brain's myelin sheath. And in a study from University of California, San Diego, it was found that there was a correlation between children receiving the MMR and were given Tylenol with a higher rate of autism. There's lots of studies. I cited dozens of studies where children were vaccinated with MMR and came down with diseases. Look at the European Journal of Epidemiology. There's a university hospital in Sweden that had studies. And autistic children have elevated levels of measles antibodies, indicating the measles vaccination may be causing autoimmunity in these children. Look at Pediatric Neurology Journal, studies at the University of Utah State University, and the British Medical Journal also had articles. So the measles, mumps, and rubella catch up immunization in the measles epidemic did not appear to confer protection and was associated with a variety of new side effects. In fact, I posted yesterday the package insert from Merck on the MMR vaccine. There's 45 paragraphs to it. And measles is the number one side effect from taking the measles vaccine. it comes down to this. All of the honest and objective physicians, including pediatricians and scientists who take the time and review the scientific literature, as we have, would never say that any vaccine has been shown to be safe or effective for every person. And in fact, the Supreme Court, in a unanimous decision, said that they are inherently unsafe. So then everything you're getting from the public are people who are biased, the physicians frequently on the payroll, getting research grants from the vaccine makers, and the media, which is fully culpable. Hope that answers your question. We'll take another call.
Hi, this is Bob from Brooklyn. I have neighbors that idolize Donald Trump, and these are low IQ, uneducated, white working class people, and they absolutely despise all non-white people, especially from the Middle East, especially Muslims. I don't understand this connection there seems to be between low IQ, uneducated people, and hatred and bigotry. I just never understood the connection, why this seems to be true almost everywhere. Can you explain, or have a guest explain, this phenomenon, this connection of low education, low IQ, and hate? So thank you.
Sir, I think that you have misinterpreted some historical facts. By your definition, every one of the people, men and women, white or black or any other background, who fought in World War I, the American Revolution, World War II, the Korean War, forget the rightness of the war, because many should never have been fought. But these were people who, more often than not, you would say would be less educated and therefore lower IQ. There's an assumption because you're not educated that you would have a low IQ, and in point of fact, no science proves that, and that these people would be filled with hate. That's what I'm hearing you say. And that if anyone who voted for Donald Trump, and especially in your neighborhood, you made the comment, all of them. Well, there were 63 million people who voted for Trump. It has been, by the closest analysis done to date, it was shown that about 13% of those people would be the hardcore Trump supporters, and they would probably fall into the categories of being reactionary, nationalistic, having tendencies to white supremacy. Okay, that would be understandable based upon hate crimes and just not crimes per se of violence, but hatred that is focused upon any race that a person disagrees with. Now, what about all the unionists? Do you realize how many unionists are not educated? Would you assume that all these white unionists that have worked diligently, honestly, honorably in American industry for their entire careers? I'm a unionist. I've always belonged in unions. I support unions. Do you think for one heartbeat that I would assume that they're all low IQ and filled with hate? No. Those kind of prejudicial statements are so lacking in any rigor of science or even empathy for the other. It also aligns itself with identity politics, which I absolutely loathe and is one of our major problems today. Think of the people who were conscientious, well-educated Democrats. They voted for Bernie Sanders. He represented a voice of reason, especially on domestic policies like Wall Street, not bailing him out again, and forgiving or reducing student loans, and helping on the domestic level. His foreign policy is as fascistic as you can get, and his support for the military-industrial complex in Israel are absolutely unshakable, unfortunately. Does that mean that Bernie Sanders, if he visited the West Bank, if he visited Gaza, if he visited Yemen, if he visited the cholera epidemic caused by the UN in Haiti, if he visited the places in Libya where organs are being sold from refugees and refugees are being sold for slaves, and the complete entire country was destroyed? Do you think that he would then say, because of my high level of education and my deep understanding of politics and because of my IQ, I'm choosing to say that none of this is important because I'm not going to address it. None of it's real because I'm not acknowledging it. The fact that a person doesn't acknowledge a problem doesn't mean the problem isn't real. And the fact that a person chooses not to judge a problem doesn't mean that they're doing so because of a lack of intellect. It frequently means a lack of character, a lack of honesty to look at a problem and deconstruct it to see what is the basis of it. So then you have all those people who voted for Trump as a resentment vote because of how utterly and completely corrupt the Democratic groups, including Debbie Wasserman Schultz and Donna and Hillary and all the other people, the permanent deep state of all of Washington are, the very same deep state that is universally accepting that we should go in and throw Maduro out of Venezuela and take it over for the interest of their oil, their military-industrial complex. Our hegemony should be more relevant as a policy than the humanitarian crisis that we help create in Venezuela. So are they all people of low intellect? Are they all people who are hate mongers? Well, they got a lot of intellect. So let's just take a look. Let's pull back from your initial, not question, but your rhetorical statement, brimming with contempt. The best and brightest, or at least what we're calling euphemistically the best and brightest, got us into the Vietnam War. Remember all the people around Kennedy? Those all came from top schools and best families. Not one would be considered a functional, illiterate, cultural illiterate, or social illiterate. They were supposed to be the cream of society. And look at the boondoggles, from the Bay of Pigs to the assassination of Kennedy, to the Vietnam War, to the assassination of the Diem brothers. Then look at, let's jump forward, Iraq War in 1991. That's Bush and all the people around him. And then look at the Iraq War under Clinton. Look at all the graduate degrees. Look at the Rhodes Scholarship, though he is a fraud because he's a functional moron. He's one of the real morons, him and George Bush and Donald Trump. Together, their IQ might register 21, 7 points each. That's not the point. Of course, I'm being, you know, sarcastic. It's to make the point that the fact that someone's in power, the most powerful position in the world, doesn't mean that they're brimming with, let's say, an understanding of what it is to be on the other end of our policies, both domestic and foreign. Because all of them, irrespective, including Obama, look at what he did. He created more wars, got us in more conflicts, had more regime change, arrested and imprisoned more whistleblowers for telling the truth about government corruption, caused more laws, including the FISA laws, to be violated. Would you say he has low IQ? Or would you say that that he is a person who has a smooth and affable personality, but is maniacal in almost sociopathic, if not so, in how he extends the influence of the state into people's lives and what it means to them? He arrested more people. He built the cages before Trump would later be identified with them. Yeah. So better pull back far enough from your assessment that someone supports Donald Trump. They're all of the same mindset. They're not. There are some, absolutely. And then, of course, when you're assessing Trump, understand the people who weren't Bernie supporters, but who simply wanted someone, anyone, to go in there and challenge the absolute death grip that the CIA, Homeland Security, the National Security State, all of the military-industrial contractors, all of the lobbyists, all of the consultants, all of the medical-industrial complex, all of the financial-industrial complex, all of the educational-industrial complex, all the private schools, all the core value, common core reading, which is a fraud, all of these complete fiascos. None of these were created by people with low IQs. All of them are people who are capable of hate because the outcome of every one of their actions is that someone else's life and quality of life was denied the same virtue that they would have expected for them, their children, and those around them. That's a different type of hatred. It isn't a raving lunatic in the street. It is the intemperance of people in corporate boardrooms sitting together, frequently on 5 to 25 different boards, receiving money, and they already have more money than they could spend, and saying, we're going to go into this country and rape its Amazon. And they have a fascist mini-Hitler running Brazil right now, who is worse than Trump, hard to imagine that, and destroying the lungs of the planet. Just when we need more lungs of the planet, we need 1 trillion trees to be planted in order to help protect the environment from the extreme consequences of global warming. And he's taking away those. But so, too, at the same time that he's doing that, China's building the largest city in the world, which will increase by at least 3% minimum our pollution levels. We just had this year, 3.2% increase in our emissions. At the time when we're being told we must cut back drastically, we're increasing. So who, sir, then, is responsible for the wars that we fight? And who's responsible for the regime changes? Who's responsible for giving payday loans and protecting the payday loan for charging 500 to 1,000% interest, destroying people's lives? Who's responsible for giving the opiates through medical doctors, the quack asses that they are, and arrogant, conceited, narcissistic? I won't tell you what I think of medicine today, but I wrote an article, Death by Medicine. The number one cause of death, doctors. Is there any concern about it? Are we panicking? Are we saying that people shouldn't go to the doctor until they first had another opinion they even need a doctor, because the doctor could be the last stop in your life, either injury or death? More people dying of cancer? No. Heart disease? No. Stroke? No. Medical iatrogenesis. So where are the headlines on that? Where's the state mandating that doctors cannot automatically treat people for different diseases with drugs that they make an extra profit on, like oncologists who can buy their chemotherapy? Are these stupid people? Are they uneducated people? They have a low IQ? Well, isn't it hate when you go ahead and over-treat someone because you're in debt and you need the extra money? Isn't it hate when you go into a country like Libya, the number one beautiful country in all of Africa, the best educated, better educated, higher level of literacy in Libya than we had in the United States? Women could not be insulted there. The most freedoms of any country in the world for Muslim women. Gaddafi didn't even run the country for 4 years before this. Why are we so stupid? But we needed to take it out because we needed his oil. We needed him not to engage in the gold denier, which would have taken the dollars, the primary currency, out. And we needed to make sure that a high personality that he had was not doing his benevolence. After all, the largest free water irrigation system in the world he created. It was equal to building the Great Pyramid. It should have been the eighth wonder of the world. And not a word about it. Not a journalist could find a single thing good to say, except he's killing his people, just like we're saying about Maduro. He's not killing his own people. Gaddafi didn't kill his own people. You know, Maduro's not killing his own people. Assad didn't kill his own people. It was this radio program on this station, only in all of America, that just about 2 months ago we played you the actual video and audio of CNN staging a false attack there by setting fire to a storage of oil, and then they set up a camera to shoot out a window exactly where this would be happening in a day. What no one realized, there was another camera behind that filming everything being staged. We, in this camera, we see that little girl who shows up in 4 separate white helmets being rescued with dust on her face. We see them putting the dust on her face. We see them making makeup, make it look like blood, and telling her father, telling her to look like, just stare down. And then being used overnight. We see the guy sitting there talking nonchalantly and then saying, are we about ready to go on? Let's get the guns shooting. Shoot the guns, start the fire. And then suddenly it comes on CNN with Anderson Cooper. Why should that surprise us? And suddenly it's, well, you know, were here and there's mortars. There was no mortars. There was no attack. It was all a complete fraud. Everyone involved should be disgraced and go to jail for that because it fostered the notion that Assad was killing his own people. What they forgot to do was turn off the damn camera that was filming all this. So what did we get? We got the camera and we got the film. We showed it. It's there on my website. You can go see it for yourself. You'll see them going back in and adjusting the camera. You'll see them talking about all this and strategizing. Wow. Are these people with low IQs? Do they have love for humanity? Did they love the Syrian people enough to falsely accuse Assad so that we could bomb them? Does Monsanto love the farmers? Does Monsanto love the bees with its neonicotinoids and the farmers getting a higher rate of leukemia and cancers? Look where we've gone with the best and brightest. So before we make an accusation that low-educated white people love Trump and hate everyone, there are going to be people like that, yes. But don't make them represent all people. Don't try to make a really broad brushstroke. Because then you're engaged in the worst form of bigotry and racism. That's enough of these calls for today. Jesus, man, I don't know how many of these. Whoa. We're going to take a break and come back and share some positive information with you. Please stay with us. We're going to go to our guest now, and as I mentioned earlier, his name is Forrest Maready, M-A-R-E-A-D-Y. We're talking to him on Skype from North Carolina, and Forrest, as I mentioned, is an independent historian, and he's had a career in film industry as an engineer, editor, composer, animator, and while in the technology industry, he designed and developed the visual effects software at NextGlass. And he is the creator of the popular video series, My Incredible Opinion. And during the past several years, Forrest has been researching some of the enigmatic riddles in science and medicine, notably the history of autism and polio. He recently published an important, highly recommended book on history associating vaccines with autism, which reads more like a detective novel. It's called The Autism Vaccine: The Story of Modern Medicine's Greatest Tragedy. He holds a degree in religion and music from Wake Forest University, and his website is forrestmayready.com. Nice to have you with us today, Forrest.
Hey, Gary. Good to be here. I'm excited. The book just came out today, and I've had a lot of interest in it, a lot of controversy around it, as you can imagine, and I'm happy to talk about it. It's an incredible story that no one seems to have researched before. It just sort of escaped historians' pen for quite a while.
Well, that's why we invited you here, and I'm happy to have you on the air, because you have a historical story to share with this audience. And as you said, nobody has heard before and is directly related to the epidemic of autism we're witnessing in this country as well as other nations, and is directly related to vaccines. And in the 19th century, when diphtheria first arrived in the United States and Europe, it took the lives of thousands of children. A vaccine was created in the 1920s, but it was not widely used until the 1930s, at which time two countries added something to this vaccine that had never been added to a vaccine before, aluminum. And it was in these two countries where symptoms that we now identify as autism and Asperger's simultaneously began to appear in record numbers. So take your time and share the real history behind the discoveries of the two doctors separated by the Atlantic Ocean and who didn't know each other, and what were they witnessed in these children following the diphtheria vaccine. The forum is yours.
Yeah, thanks, Gary. The most people think of autism and vaccines, and they think of the Lancet paper in 1998 with Andy Wakefield and 12 other doctors at the Royal Free Hospital in London. And I wanted to understand, where does it start? Where does the association between vaccination and autism actually begin? And I went on a wild ride of research, and as you just summarized really nicely, diphtheria appeared in the United States, and it appeared in some other countries in the 1800s, and it was a horrible infection. It's a bacterial infection that creates white, leathery patches on your tongue and your throat, and it makes it really hard to breathe and eat. If you're an adult, you can kind of suffer through it, but if you're a kid with a really small mouth, you know, it makes it difficult, and a lot of kids were dying from it, and they developed, you can call it a vaccine, it's not technically what it was, but it was grown in horses, just like the tetanus shot. They used horse blood to develop antibodies to the toxin the bacteria produced. And it wasn't a very effective shot, but the real problem was it created what they called serum sickness. You can imagine injecting horse blood into a kid is not super healthy. They didn't know it at the time, but it was actually allergy. They had never seen allergy before, and in fact, until 1904, there wasn't even a term for allergy or anaphylaxis. They had to create the term because until they started injecting people with stuff, they had never seen it before. So aluminum, in the 1920s, they started experimenting, and they realized that by adding an aluminum compound, which originally was called potassium aluminum sulfate or potash, if you've ever heard of that, it could increase the immune system's response to the shot. And it worked so well, they couldn't believe their luck. It was like all scientific discovery. It was just a fortuitous event where some of this aluminum was added to something they gave to the horses, and the horses produced prodigious amounts of antibodies in days instead of months. So by 1930, they decided, let's test this in children and see if it helps them respond better. And in fact, it did. It's an incredible ingredient that makes the immune system absolutely freak out. It hates this compound, and it makes the immune system react really strongly to whatever is injected along with it. And in fact, today, scientists use this compound, which is now aluminum hydroxide, to study food allergy. That's how they purposefully induce food allergy in the animals they study. It's how they study asthma. It's how they purposefully induce asthma in lab animals. But the real problem with aluminum, the acute problem, is it's a neurotoxin. It destroys the myelin sheath that coats the axons, which are like the nerves, the wiring of your brain. They're protected by a fatty compound, a myelin sheath, and this aluminum ingredient that's in vaccines destroys that myelin sheath, and it causes all sorts of short-circuiting. They didn't know that at the time, so they started adding it to the diphtheria vaccine, as you said, in 1932. And the reason it was such a hit is because they said it only required one shot. That was a big deal for parents back then. If you know anything about allergy, you know the initial exposure is not that bad. Your body may have a faint reaction to it. It's the second exposure and the third exposure where you have full-on anaphylaxis. That's where it can be deadly. So doctors and physicians advertised this new diphtheria vaccine. It was aluminum precipitated. That meant it contained this new ingredient that they were really excited about because the hope was it would only require one shot. So in 1932, the United States had a massive nationwide campaign to immunize children against diphtheria. This was the only pediatric vaccine that children routinely received at that time. People may think, well, what about smallpox? Smallpox wasn't a shot that most kids got. They only got it if there was an epidemic coming their way, and they would get it then. Because smallpox, you can kind of see it coming. Diphtheria was the first time public health officials had really gotten a lot of even corporate funding to help them publicize this new shot. the aluminum precipitated diphtheria campaign. That was in 1932. And as you mentioned, within a year or two, children started to exhibit some very strange neurological symptoms that had really never been seen before. In the United States, the preeminent child psychiatrist in the country was named Leo Kanner. He wrote columns in newspapers. He wrote books. He would give talks. He was the main guy when it came to childhood psychiatry. In fact, he wrote a book in 1935, a 500-page book on childhood psychiatric disorders. It was considered the Bible for anyone who studied children and issues with their brain. He had never seen this before. He didn't mention it in his 500-page book, and he started cataloging these children that ended up showing up in his clinic at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore because it was so unique. He felt that he had to mention it, and in 1943, he released a paper of 11 of the children he had seen, trying to describe the behaviors because he was just so confused. And as you mentioned, this is the real bit of research that I was able to uncover that I've never heard anyone talk about. At that same time, Austria was undergoing a nationwide diphtheria immunization campaign. Just like the United States, they'd been having children dying from it. It was a horrible illness. And they, too, made the switch to the aluminum-containing vaccine. They tested it out. They felt like it was potentially safe enough. And so they switched over to it around that exact same time. In Vienna, there was a psychiatrist there named Hans Asperger. And he started seeing children show up in his clinic. And he started documenting their strange behaviors. Now, both of these psychiatrists were from Austria. One had emigrated here, Leo Kanner. He headed up the clinic in Baltimore. And Hans Asperger just worked in Austria. That was his native country. But interestingly, they weren't aware of each other. They had no idea each other were seeing the same thing. And they published papers within a year of each other. And they both used a term that most people had never heard of before. They described the children as autistic. And autistic was a symptom that people had been using to describe children or adults with schizophrenia. And it meant this withdrawn isolation that these children were showing, this aloneness, this unwillingness or inability to socialize with others, even their parents. So by complete coincidence, two doctors, two childhood psychiatrists in two different countries, at the same time this new vaccine was being introduced into the pediatric population, they both started seeing cases of this new disorder appear, and they both called it autism. So what's really fascinating and horrible is this coincidence has never been discussed. This historical event that the very two countries where autism was first discovered were the same countries that had nationwide campaigns for diphtheria, the same countries that introduced this new aluminum-containing ingredient into the diphtheria vaccine. Now, that should concern anyone who studies autism, because some people will say, well, autism has always existed, and we're just now diagnosing it more. But the reality is two of the preeminent child psychiatrists in the world had never seen it. They had never heard of it. So to say that they were just missing it is really difficult for me to believe. And there's another component that really blew them away, which was they were nearly all boys. Eight of the 11 Leo Kanner described were boys, and all 200 of the boys Hans Asperger had seen were boys. If you go back through the psychological reports of these different institutions, asylums, if you go back through all the 1800s and early 1900s, you will never see anything that has a 4-to-1 prevalence of male to female. If autism had existed in some other form, you would see it bubble to the surface. even if you didn't call it the same thing, if the symptoms weren't described the same way, if something's lost in translation, those numbers should make autism appear wherever you look, because it's 4-1, and it doesn't. It was never there. There was no autism at the numbers these doctors were seeing. Sure, there might have been an isolated case here or there. And in fact, I found what I believe is one of the earliest cases, someone Charles Bell described in the early 1800s, someone, a kid I would describe as having autism. But you don't see it very much at all, an isolated case every, let's say, 30 or 40 or 50 years. So the book follows two children who were born at that time, 1933 and 1934. One of them is named Donald Triplett, and he was the first child ever officially diagnosed with autism. He was case one in Leo Connor's paper. The other child is someone most people don't know much about, although they should. Her name was Emily Dionne, and she was one of the Dionne quintuplets. And in the 1930s, quintuplets were born in Canada, and the world became obsessed with them. They were fascinated. They were more famous than anyone. Celebrities drove to Canada. Royalty came from England. Everyone wanted to meet these five little girls. And interestingly, when the new diphtheria vaccine came out, the Dionne quintuplets were used as part of a publicity stunt to help market the new vaccine. And so in 1935, I believe it was, plastered all over papers were pictures of the five little girls getting the new aluminum-containing shot. And Emily Dionne, one of the girls, immediately started having problems. And although they tried to hide it from the public view, if you do research into their story, you'll see that she was really affected in some way. And she had seizures. She had what they called fainting spells. And it's a real tragic story. If you follow her development, you can see that something was different about her.
So, Forrest, unfortunately, we're out of time. I would just end with this. You mentioned in your last sentence about how this evolves in the public's mind. And it was Edward Bernays. He was the father of American propaganda. And he said the mind of the people is made up for it by those persons who understand the manipulation of public opinion, and therefore instill in them inherited prejudices and verbal formulas. And today, when you talk about being an anti-vaxxer, there is no such thing as an anti-vaxxer. Every one of the people who are challenging vaccine were pro-vaccine until they were damaged. So instead of even giving them the benefit of telling these are victims, real victims, the propaganda machine of Edward Bernays is in full effect today, and now there is a pejorative anti-vaxxer instead of an informed citizen after the damage, after the fact. Thank you very much. Yours is a very important work. We need to know more about this. And my guest is Forrest Mayready, M-A-R-E-A-D-Y, and his book is outright just today, and is called The Autism Vaccine, The Story of Modern Medicine's Greatest Tragedy. Now we get the backstory. Now we get the foundational information. Forrest, all the best to you with your new book and sharing this information.
Thanks.
I'm Gary Nall. Yes. We're out of time. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone.